Once again, good morning. We're going to try today to complete our discussion of the objectivist ethics by applying what we have said about principles to the virtues of integrity and honesty. Before we do, however, I want to make one clarification of what I said last time. I was asked an excellent question, which I was sorry I hadn't been asked during the class, and for a conscientious, dedicated audience, it involves an important clarification, so give me one moment to do that before we pick up where we left off. I was asked at the end of the class last time, is it possible for a man to be too long range? And this was asked in private, and the answer to that is yes. There is a real sense in which you can overdo a good and necessary thing. It's only a good, repressed type of person who would do it. But I'm thinking of the kind of person who always lives in the future, whose whole life is the distant goals he wants to attain, and doesn't take any time or devote any focus to living in the present, enjoying the present, and doing things because of the pleasure of the moment rather than because of what they will lead to in the distant future. Now, of course, this is a complete error. Long range means long range action in order to attain ends, but if you don't enjoy those ends in the present as and when you attain them, and if you don't get some pleasure in the moment in the process, then your whole life is lived on hold, deferred for one spasm of ecstasy before you die. Life is a process, and you have to have the time to enjoy it day by day, or at least week by week, here and now and in the present. You have to conduct your life so that the principles guiding you and your ultimate goals and your productive goals are long range. But in the course of enacting them, you have time and focus for enjoyment of the moment. And there should be many activities that you engage in, which you can say, this is not a means to some distant end. This here and now is the pleasure of the moment. Making love is an obvious example. Playing baseball, having a drink, sitting back and contemplating your achievement. I don't have to enumerate all these, but your life should be rich in pleasures of the moment. Otherwise, as I say, you're deferring the purpose of it all. Now, there is no conflict between the short range and the long range. You don't have to weigh them. If you define your long range principles rationally, there should be stops and steps of achievement and pleasure possible to you throughout, and in fact, adherence to those principles will enable you to get more pleasure out of each of your short-range momentary enjoyments. So the one is a means to the other. They complement each other. But it is possible, I just wanted to make this clarification, out of an excess of zeal to defer your entire life for the long range, and that is a mistake. Having said that, let us pick up principles which does stress the issue of the long range. We explained why principles are man's means of determining how to achieve a long range goal, why they must be an absolute, and we gave as the example the principle of rationality as against emotionalism. Now I want to apply what we've learned to another virtue, the virtue of integrity. And that's where I came to grasp fully the issue of moral principle myself at a certain point, which I'll mention when we get there. Now, I'm not going to lecture on integrity in general. I assume you know that that is the virtue of being loyal in action to your convictions and values. It comes from the term integration. Integrity is a man who is a whole, a unit, who is not split into a part which preaches versus a part which acts. A man who acts in accordance with what he believes. Now, the main opposition to integrity today comes from the modern cult of compromise. The idea that there are no absolutes, you don't have to adhere to principle in any conflict with someone, the solution is compromise. Compromise, of course, being an adjustment of conflicting claims by mutual concessions. And I want to pick up here with the notion of compromise and see where that leads us. Now, the first point is that we are talking about a compromise in regard to a principle when we talk about an immoral action, not a compromise in regard to details or concretes. And I will just remind you here of Ayn Rand's classic example of the difference between these two kinds of compromise. The example she gives of a perfectly legitimate compromise, which involves no immorality, would be two traders who agree that the buyer of an article is obliged to pay the seller for it, but disagree about the item's financial worth. And they resolve the conflict by finding an intermediate price acceptable to both. As against, and here would be the example she gives of a moral compromise, a man dealing with a customer, in quotes, who expects simply to seize the goods he wants without any payment. The adjustment, that is what constitutes the compromise then, consisting in the owner agreeing to give the burglar or the customer free of charge only part of the goods that he came to steal. Now this would be compromise in regard to principle, and as Ms. Rand observes, it would mean, quote, a total surrender, the recognition of the burglar's right to one's property, end quote. Once you make this kind of concession, you leave yourself helpless, because you not only give up some of your property, you also abandon to any random claimant the principle of ownership. The burglar thereby gains the upper hand in his relationship with you and the power to determine its future. He gains the inestimable advantage of being sanctioned as virtuous. What he concedes in the compromise is merely a concrete. Namely, he gives up some of the loot temporarily. Temporarily because now there is no way to stop him when he comes back with a new demand tomorrow. Now this same kind of analysis applies to every case of moral compromise. And here are some more examples of varying degrees of familiarity to you, but all illustrating this same point. Take a country with the means to defend itself that capitulates in the name of being flexible to some of the arbitrary demands of an aggressor. Not all of them, but some of them. Well, obviously, it thereby invites more demands, which it's going to answer by more flexibility. This kind of country is doomed from the start, assuming that it doesn't at some point change its fundamental policy and that that doesn't happen too late in the progression. The point here is that by conceding the propriety of, quote, some aggression, only a bit, it has thereby dropped the principle of self-defense and of its own sovereignty. And that leaves it without moral grounds to object to the next depredation. Or take a domestic political example rather than a foreign policy example. Suppose you accept the, quote, moderate idea that individual rights can be overridden by government controls if the public welfare requires it. Not always and not thrown out completely, but only when the public welfare requires it, which is what today's moderates, liberal and conservative alike, say. By that fact, if you take that approach, you have agreed that individual rights are not inalienable, that the public welfare comes above them. In other words, that we each as individuals exercise certain prerogatives not by right at all, but by the permission of society as represented by the government. In other words, you have entirely repudiated the principle of individual rights in favor of the principle of statism. In other words, what is significant here is you set out to achieve a compromise between clashing systems, and yet in the very act of compromise, in the first step of this compromise, the essence of one system, capitalism, has been bodily thrown out, while the essence of the other, socialism, has become the ruling absolute. And this happens in the first step of an action whose goal was to combine the two. And yet one was jettisoned altogether in the beginning. And this is why a mixed economy always philosophically has to move towards socialism. This is the basic philosophic reason. Let me take one more example. Imagine a judge on the bench who says, I don't want to go to extremes in regard to justice. Of course, I don't want to go to extremes in regard to injustice either. And his bosses demand certain favors from him, so he decides to modify justice by a small dose of political favoritism. Now, in the very act of doing so, he's dropped the principle of justice, because justice cannot countenance a single act of injustice. What then is setting the terms of this judge's compromise? What is deciding his verdicts now? It is the principle of favoritism. Favoritism permits him whatever whims the bosses authorize, including even many verdicts that aren't tainted, so long as this is politically palatable to his bosses. So a fair verdict is possible in such a course, but only by accident. The essence of the system is the elimination of fairness in favor of pull. Now, we saw last time that the attempt to reach a compromise between rationality and emotionalism means the total rejection of reason and the enshrinement of the principle of emotionalism. Well, what these examples should indicate to you is that that same argument applies, as in logic it would have to any moral compromise. Either you accept any rational principle as an absolute, or you reject it 100%. Now, let's state the abstraction that governs this. There is no man's land between opposite principles. No middle of the road which is untouched by either of the opposites or shaped equally by both. The fact is that a human being simply cannot escape the rule of some kind of principles. Because being human, we're conceptual. And you cannot act without the guidance of some fundamental integrations. This is the issue that we simply can't deal with a mass of data. We would just stare blindly at it. The mind would be overloaded. The crow epistemology, we couldn't encompass it intellectually without some kind of principle, conscious or subconscious. And yet we're not built and pre-wired to function automatically, and so we would just be stopped altogether. So you cannot literally escape some kind of principle. You have to act, knowingly or otherwise, on some sort of principle. But the crucial point here is a parallel to economics. Just as in economics, bad money drives out good, in morality, bad principles drive out good ones. If you try to combine a rational principle with its antithesis, that very act immediately eliminates the rational principle and establishes the irrational one. In other words, if you try to make a deal with the devil, then you lose 100%. And I quote from Miss Rand here, "In any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit." Now, this is the point where I went into a tailspin trying to explain the deeper reason. This was, to me, the turning point. Because I asked myself, well, food and poison is an analogy, but why should it be on the level of moral principle? Why does it have to be that if you try to compromise between these two principles, the evil one wins? After all, good is more powerful than evil. This was my mental process. So why couldn't you, in theory, combine some element of evil with good and still the good would overpower the evil? It made it seem as though evil must be tremendously potent, that if you accept one drop of it, The good is wiped out. And yet, you worked out various examples, and you see that there's a definite disparity. On the face of it, it looked like the scales were tipped in favor of evil. For instance, take the United States and Russia at the bargaining table. Now, Russia, it became obvious, is entirely happy to compromise and gains from compromising. It comes to the bargaining table with all kinds of incredible demands, you know, for complete disarmament or evacuation of Europe or handover the states west of the Mississippi or whatever it is, and it's delighted to compromise. And on the other hand, the United States, in that process, has to be careful and scrupulous. If it gives away one thing, right away the process is started of complete subversion. Or the same is true of the same is true of a businessman and a bureaucrat. When he is interviewed, you know, and they try to strike a deal, the bureaucrat, like Mr. Thompson, is perfectly friendly. He's willing to make any deal in the world. He comes in with his demands, and if you don't want to meet them, let's negotiate, the way Mr. Thompson was happy to make a deal with Galt. But if the businessman enters that process and concedes on the first level, well, okay, you can control my profits, but not my wages, or you can control my prices on Tuesday, but not on Thursday, then he's wiped out. This is true throughout, if you go through the various examples. And it seemed on the face of it to make evil more potent than good. Like, evil could be freewheeling, self-confident, you know, negotiate and come out smelling like a rose, whereas the good had to be so careful, and it seemed on the face of it so weak that it couldn't withstand even a particle of evil. And I was stopped on that for a substantial period of time until I got the point, and that was, to me, the final integration necessary to grasp why principle is truly indispensable. And I want to read you now the few pages in which I finally elaborated this point. Out of curiosity, what would you say in answer to this? Why is it that there seems to be this disparity that evil has no problem with compromise and good does? Yes.
Because it has only to gain from any kind of evil interaction with the good.
Well, you're certainly on the track. You say evil only stands to gain and the good only stands to lose. But that is certainly very, very relevant, but we need to go a little bit deeper. You're obviously way ahead of me, because it took me a long time to get to that point. Yes?
It has absolutely nothing to offer. The minute you go to the bargaining table in all of it, then you've lost.
Well, you say it has nothing to offer. That's on the road to the solution. In fact, if you understand that deeply, it is the solution. But I think we can do it. All right, I see already you're ahead of me. So I'm not going to baffle you with this the way I was baffled, but let me tell you now my few pages that I wrote answering this question. The reason, I'll paraphrase it, because if I read it just as written, it's too fast, it'll be over before you hear it. The reason why evil wins in any compromise is not that evil is more powerful than good. On the contrary, the reason is that evil is powerless and therefore can exist only as a parasite on the good. Now let's elaborate that. The good here means the rational. That which conforms to the demands of reality, and thereby fosters man's life. Now, a policy so defined, that which conforms to reality and fosters life, obviously has to be upheld and practiced with complete consistency. It acquires no advantages from its antithesis. And here I quote a sentence from Miss Rand. The rational has nothing to gain from the irrational except a share of its failures and crimes. And now to continue with the examples we were using. A property owner doesn't need the help of a burglar who's trying to loot him. Nor does a free country need the attacks of an aggressor. Nor does an individual seeking to sustain himself need the jails of a dictator. Nor does the administration of justice benefit from subversion by corrupt bosses. By its very nature, the good only loses by trafficking with the evil. Now, the evil is in exactly the opposite position. The evil here is the irrational, that which contradicts the facts of reality and thereby threatens human life. Well, a policy of this kind clearly cannot be practiced consistently. You can't follow it as an absolute. What would happen if you did? Immediate destruction. Evil, therefore, has to count on some element of the good. It can exist only as an exception to the virtues on which it is relying. It can exist only as an exception to the virtues on which it is relying. It's intrinsically parasitical. And I quote from Ms. Rand again, "The irrational has everything to gain from the rational, a share of its achievements and values," unquote. Now to apply it to our examples, a producer doesn't need a burglar, but a burglar does need the producer on whom he preyed. And so do bandit nations need freer countries. Observe that they don't seek to annihilate freer countries, but to rule them, take them over, and loot them. And observe on the domestic issue, no collectivist wants to throttle every act of individual self-assertion. Not even the Nazis or the communists. They need men to think and act to some extent, or their own regimes would collapse. The closest they came to trying to throttle every such action, every individual act, was the concentration camp. And of course there, they didn't require their functioning for the survival of the country. And no political boss seeks to reverse every proper verdict. On the contrary, that boss mentality counts on the appearance of justice so that men will respect and obey the courts, so that then, when he wishes it, the boss can intervene behind the scenes and cash in on their respect. In other words, the crucial thing is evil is not consistent and does not want to be consistent. That, to me, was the crucial insight. What evil wants by its very nature is to get away with injecting itself into the life-sustaining process sometimes. Short range, out of context, at whim. That's all it wants. And to achieve that, all it needs is a single concession by the good, namely a concession of the principle involved, a concession that the evil is proper, quote, sometimes. That kind of compromise is a total charter of liberty for evil, because thereafter the irrational is free to set the terms and spread by further whim until there's nothing left of the good or man. So the power of the good is enormous, but depends absolutely on its consistency. That is why the good has to be an issue of all or nothing, black or white, and why evil by its nature has to be partial, occasional, now and then gray. Observe, and you can multiply this because I found many examples of it in thinking about this issue. When we call someone a liar, if I tell you you're a liar, in common parlance, this is even outside anybody who has highfalutin philosophy, that is not a man, a liar, who always conscientiously tells falsehoods. There is no such creature. If the term is to apply to you, a few big whoppers on your part is enough. Just as a hypocrite is not a man who scrupulously betrays every one of his own ideas. Just as a burglar is not a man who steals from everybody he meets. Just as a person is a killer if he respects human life 99.9% of the time and hires himself out to the mafia as an executioner only now and then. Now, this applies to every kind of corruption. To be evil, quote, only sometimes is to be evil. To be good means to be good all of the time. In other words, as a matter of consistent, rational principle without exception. Now, this is the deeper reason why objectivism is so antagonistic to the notion of compromise in the unprincipled sense, which is the cult ruling our society today. Those advocates of compromise would achieve the same end result that they are achieving much more honestly if they simply dropped the equivocation and said outright, we are devil worshippers, drop the good and practice the evil. Evil is delighted to compromise. For evil, compromise means total victory, the only kind of victory that it is capable of achieving, namely the victory of plundering, subverting, and ultimately destroying the good. Some principle, in short, always wins in human behavior. We simply cannot escape the power of principle. And the facts are that if the right one is not an absolute, then the other, the evil one, takes over. Because the essence of the right is consistency. The essence of the wrong in this context is the opposite of consistency, the need to be inconsistent. So if you ask me, well, are you saying all men then are principled? You have to make a distinction, as the scholastics would say. In one sense, obviously, it is not true that all men are principled. Why would a class in principles be necessary if it was unavoidable? Obviously, there are many cases of people who don't conceptualize, who are unthinking, concrete-bound. They are not guided by any principle. And in this sense, not all men are principled. To be principled in this way is an achievement, not an unavoidable state of mind. But there is another sense in which all men do and must function by principle, whether they like it or not, and whether they know it or not. That is the sense in which a conceptual being simply cannot avoid integration. It cannot avoid some kind of guidance. Even if he goes by his feelings and doesn't know where they came from, they had to come from somewhere, which means some kind of ideological conceptual evaluations and conclusions. And in that way, you simply cannot escape the kind of integration that we describe as a principle. The crucial difference here is between rational principles held consciously and irrational ones held subconsciously. If you are unprincipled in the conscious realm, you default. You don't define and adhere as an absolute to rational principles, then you will be principled in the bad sense subconsciously. The evil will be your guide. In other words, you can't escape integration, but you can escape consistent, methodical, rational integration, which means you can escape the good and thereby succumb to the haphazard, the whimsical, the inconsistent, in other words, the irrational, the evil. So we come back to the point that the good cannot be achieved automatically, mindlessly, by accident, by short-range desire. By that method, we can achieve only inconsistency, the anti-reality, and ultimately destruction. In other words, to summarize the whole thing, if you avoid principles in the conscious realm, you are doomed to destructive principles subconsciously. And therefore, obviously, in reason and logic, there's only one choice, and that is to act by consistent, rational principles held as absolutes. And that, I think, is the deepest reason why any idea of the middle of the road is invalid. It's an assault by its nature on the requirements of a conceptual being, and it dooms you by its nature to the worst possible course. I know that made it clearer to me than it was previously to grasp this point. Now, the essence of morality is applying this recognition of the role of principles to every key moral issue, I think. That is the essence of what people really don't understand about morality. And there has been tremendous distortion because people don't understand the necessity of principle. And to illustrate this, I want to go now to the virtue of honesty and show you one more way in which the whole thing comes back to the issue of principle. I'm going to start here on the virtue of honesty by quoting another statement from Miss Rand that I know many people find baffling. That is to say, they simply can't see how it could be taken literally as true. She says, honesty is, quote, the recognition of the fact that the unreal is unreal and can have no value. Now listen to this next part. That neither love nor fame nor cash is a value if obtained by fraud. Unquote. Now that takes us back to the introduction to this unit in which I said people ask, I can see why you would say it's wrong to steal $1 million. But how can you possibly say that if you did it, $1 million wouldn't at least be of value? You could get an education with it. You could advance objectivism. You could buy a Mercedes. You could travel to Europe. Maybe the objectivist position is, okay, it's wrong. You shouldn't do it because the value is outweighed by the evil. That's the trade-off view that I presented to you at the beginning of this unit. But how can you say flatly, neither love nor fame nor cash is a value at all if obtained by fraud? Isn't the truth that it's a value, but it's outweighed by other values? Now, the objectivist position here depends entirely, and Miss Rand couldn't have stated it better. It's not, it would be a value, but there's a bigger one. It's that it is not a value at all if obtained by fraud. And that was actually illustrated in Atlas when Dagny got that huge check for betraying Galt and regarded it as a scrap of paper. That was a kind of extreme, dramatic illustration of the fact that it's not just, well, what can I do with this as against the other? The thing is not of value. Now, I want to work through an example here, which I have gone through in some detail, to reach the final theory as to why this isn't of value at all. And this actually takes me back, if you're interested, to one of my earliest philosophic conversations with Ayn Rand in 1952 with regard to why you should be honest. I referred to this in my recent Ford Hall talk, this discussion. I'm going to give you the substance of it now. This is where she asked me to make up. Is there an echo still? She asked me to make up a plausible example of dishonesty and then work it through. So I'm posing the problem this way. This is a standard type of example. I don't remember that this was the actual example I used because I can't remember the details back to 52. But I do remember this is exactly the type of example, and what I'm giving as the analysis was exactly what she did to me, and even in much more excruciating detail than I'm giving you here. She believed in chewing one concrete thoroughly, and then you go home and do the other. Why, people ask, should a man not execute a well-planned swindle? Sell stock in a fake gold mine, say. And then, ill-gotten cash in hand, take off for parts unknown. Free to enjoy all the advantages of money without the need to work. That's the question. Well, let us begin, she told me, by concretizing the dishonesty this kind of behavior would involve. Let us see what it actually would mean in step by step. The con man in this case would have to lie, for instance, about such things as the location, discovery, and the history of the mine. To avoid detection, say, he places it in a distant country. He'd have to lie about the number of workers and the scale of operations. The mine doesn't exist. The quantity and quality of the mine's output. He would presumably present his investors with some sort of proof that the mine has been properly registered, which would, of course, be a fake, and that the ore has been competently assayed. And that raises the question, does he fabricate documents from real agencies or does he fabricate whole agencies? He would have to lie about some sort of proof that the foreign government involved is and will remain favorable to this enterprise, if anybody asks him. And of course, he'd have to lie through his teeth about the killing that his investors can expect to make, judging by current market conditions and the best economic forecast. In addition, if anybody asks, he'd probably have to lie about the identity of his partners and his other investors, lie about his background and qualifications, lie about his references, and then he's got the question here, does he use Confederates and lie to them also, since he's afraid fully to trust them? He'd have to lie to his bank, say, when he deposits the victim's huge checks, lie to his friends before he disappears so that he can't be traced, and then, let's say, having started his new life, lie to any new acquaintances about where he used to live, what he used to do, and how he got his money, or else lie to conceal the fact that he does have money, etc., etc. Now, if you trace it out, you would see that every one of these lies, by its nature as a lie, clashes with one or more facts, and thereby creates a risk of his detection and exposure by any man who has access to the facts. Anyone in this example who happens to know something about mining, or the distribution of gold deposits, or the science of geology, or the particular area claimed as the site, or the policies of the foreign government, or the agencies of mine registration and assay, or market conditions and economic forecast, or about con men in general, or about this one in particular, about his associates, or his typical haunts, or his regional accent, or his spending habits, or his MO. Any of these people with any of this kind of knowledge become a threat to be dealt with as needed by further lies. Lies tailored to each individual, lies designed to cash in on this person's special ignorance, and yet contradictory lies to stay clear of that person's special knowledge. And then in the end, if we suppose that he runs out of loot and that the swindler hasn't been caught, the very premises that led him to carry out the scheme successfully, as he thinks, will most likely prompt him to embark on another one involving a whole new pack of lies. Now, all of this that I gave you, of course, is merely details. None may be applicable in a particular case. Philosophy cannot tell us to which lies a given individual will resort, nor to how many, nor how rapidly he will escalate his falsehoods, nor how skillfully or ineptly he will do it. Philosophy can tell us only the principle. Since reality is a unity, since all facts are interconnected, the first step of the deceit places the individual in conflict, not merely with an isolated datum, but with what? Reality as such. And this is an exact parallel here. In fact, it's an instance of what principle that we discussed last time. The first evasion puts you in opposition to reality as such. In other words, like the evader, the dishonest individual cannot ultimately contain the process. One way or the other, he is committed to the invention of a growing realm of unreality, which is like a supernatural dimension that clashes increasingly with the actual world. Reality, therefore, becomes his nemesis. It becomes a time bomb waiting to explode in his face. Now, of course, the bomb may not go off. The liar may evade the power of his nemesis of reality, and he may actually get away with any given scheme. He may, in effect, win the battle, But if such are the battles he is fighting, he has to lose the war. Now let's see what happens to his character in the process. First thing he loses, I don't even bother about rationality because he's already committed to a war against reality, so we don't have to discuss, is he rational? The first thing he loses besides rationality is his independence. Does he count on his independent cognition in order to live? Obviously not. He's given up cognition of reality as a method of functioning and is counting instead on what? His ability to manipulate his victims. People become to him more real than the elements of reality left that he still recognizes. People become his means of survival. And not even people as such. Only people qua deludable. In other words, insofar as they are ignorant, blind, gullible. What this kind of person believes and expects, what they expect falsely, thanks to him, that is the power the liar has to deal with, pander to, and strive to satisfy. Now, of course, the liar thinks in his own mind that he has turned other people into his puppets. But the fact is, his course makes him a second-hander and thus their pawn. It makes him a dependent of the lowest kind. A dependent not merely on the consciousness of others, which is bad enough, but on their unconsciousness. And thus Ms. Rand's statement that this kind of person is a fool, quote, a fool whose source of values is the fools he succeeds in fooling, close quote. Now we could give the same kind of analysis with regard to every moral virtue and value in regard to the con man or the liar. Could he be a man of integrity? Well, obviously his method of action consists in throwing out moral principles and trying to get away out of context with the fraud of the moment. Can he be productive? Well, sometimes he might, as an accident, but his policy is to live not by creative work, but by bilking others of the fruits of their work. Is he just? Well, obviously, his goal is to gain the unearned from innocent victims, so he's obviously thrown out justice. Is he self-confident? Well, not if the term means confidence in one's ability to grasp and deal with reality. That's his nemesis. Is he happy? Well, not if happiness presupposes moral character and the pursuit of rational values. Not if it presupposes harmony with reality. Can he be proud? Yes, he can, in one depraved sense. Proud of his ability to delude others, to break the laws of human life, to cheat on reality, and get away with it, which, however, he can't do. There used to be a saying among certain wise men in the ancient world that virtue is one. It was actually certain Platonists said that. By which they meant that to cheat on any of its aspects is to cheat on all. And this is a profound truth, particularly in the objectivist code, where all the virtues are aspects of one principle, namely rationality. The dishonest man, therefore, is not only dishonest. In the process, he has to betray every moral requirement of human life, and thereby systematically, methodically court failure, pain, destruction. And now the point to see is that this is true by the very nature of dishonesty. In other words, of the principle that it involves, even if the liar is never found out and proceeds to amass a fortune. If you know Plato and the Republic, he gives the example of Gyges, guy who gets a hold of a magic ring that makes him invisible, and he proceeds to rape and plunder and lie and etc. He can have whatever he wants and he doesn't get caught. And Plato asks, what is the answer? Why should you be moral? Why should you be honest if you had the ring of Gyges? And his essential answer is, you'll get yours in the next life. But the proper answer is, the fundamental avenger of your life of lies or more broadly, immorality is not the victims or the police, but one thing that you cannot escape, namely reality itself. In other words, in the nature of dishonesty, you have thrown out the principle of conformity to reality. You've adopted the principle instead, therefore, of war with reality. You have accepted a breach with reality, and that very breach annihilates the good and shifts you now to the side of the evil. So you lose everything. And now against that background, let us look at the so-called trade-off view of ethics. It should be pretty apparent to you why there's no trade-off here, but let's take it step by step. I mean, it's 100% loss now, but let's take it step by step. The advocates of the trade-off view of ethics say, you know, you do this scheme or you lie, you make $1 million, that the $1 million might be a real value to the liar, but then you have to weigh that value against the disvalues, such as others will retaliate, you'll lose your reputation, the police might catch you, etc. You have a kind of calculus, you know, I get 10 units of good, 15 units of bad, so I guess in the long run, it isn't worth it. Now, that kind of calculus is entirely rejected by objectivism. And I hope you can see that it rests on a non-objective approach to the whole subject of values and evaluation. Why would the $1 million be regarded as a value, even in the context that to get it you have to lie and cheat? What two theories alone could ascribe value to $1 million regardless of the methods by which you attain it? There's only two theories that could do it. One would say, well, $1 million just is a value. That's part of being $1 million. It has a little packet inside, and if you rip the paper open, value would spring up. Now, what is that theory called? Intrinsicism. And the other is, a value is whatever I want to be a value. If I want $1 million, that's what makes it a value, because I want it, and that is subjectivism. The idea of this kind of calculus rests entirely on your choice is only intrinsicism versus subjectivism. If, however, you hold the objective view of value, which of course follows from the objective view of cognition, the entire picture is completely altered. The $1 million is nothing in itself. It has to be evaluated by us. It has no intrinsic evaluation. We have to evaluate it. And not subjectively, but objectively, in accordance with a rational standard, which, since we're conceptual beings, already imposes on us, therefore, the necessity of living by certain principles. The common view gives you no way whatever to decide. They say, have a calculus, and then simply decide which leads to the better result. How do you know? Let's suppose we put that calculus on the board and we say the $1 million is on the side of good and being arrested by the police and spending 5 years in jail is on the side of the bad. Well, now what? How do you decide? Well, the intrinsicist quote just knows that jail is worse than the million. How does he just know? Well, he claims he gets it from God or intuition, but actually he just feels it. And the subjectivist says, I just feel it. So they have absolutely no way of performing the calculus that they recommend that we perform. They simply say, make a chart and then go by blind feeling, whatever it evokes in you. So this is just a fancy way of urging emotionalism. And if you're going to be emotionalist, why should you go through the pretense of a chart and weighing and so on? John Dewey strongly countenanced such a chart, weigh all the pros and cons, but he was the great pragmatist because he said the way you weigh them is you go by your feeling or society's feeling. So all that, once you say the $1 million is a value, you wipe out everything. You wipe out the need of principles, you wipe out the objective approach to values, and you commit yourself to emotionalism. And that's why even the people who attempt to be reasonable in moral thought are just simply out of the picture because they do not grasp the role of principles, because beneath that they don't grasp such an idea as objective value, because beneath that they don't grasp objectivity in cognition. Now you see why we throw out the trade-off idea altogether. And here there's a perfect, it's not even an analogy, it's the same thing in a different field. Just as no statement can be declared a truth out of context, so no object can be declared a value out of context. If you want to evaluate any particular object or course of action, you want to say $1 million is good, or a piece of pie is good, not just that it tastes good, because that's a sensation, but that it's good, it's a worthwhile thing to eat. Before you can evaluate a particular course of action or a particular object, you have to first define its relationship in the full context to the moral principles required by man's life. If, in the context, the object conforms to moral principles, in other words, what you would have to do to get it is a perfectly moral process, then and only then can you proceed to weigh pros and cons. Then you may find, well, it would be proper to do it. I don't have to involve myself in any immorality or breach with reality. Now, is it worth it? And this is what I have to gain and this is what I have to lose. Maybe I won't go to class today because it's raining. Of course, that would be immoral if I said that. But as a student, I could say it's raining so I don't feel like going to class, and I'm prepared to have a calculus. I'm not saying it's always wrong to have a trade-off, what you gain and what you lose. I'm saying a trade-off is applicable only when you've got the green light from moral principles. If a course of behavior requires you to violate a proper principle, in other words, if in any form it involves a breach with reason and reality, of which dishonesty is only one example, that's the end of the question, and there's no trade-off to consider, no calculus to perform, there's no value to gain then, because there's only destruction. And the best example I could give you of this in a common sense term is, would you debate cutting off your head in order to gain $1 million? Or even $1 trillion? Would you weigh, well, the gain on one side against the loss on the other? Or would you say, I can't call something a gain, I cannot apply that term, if the requirement of attaining it is this sort of loss? And the same exactly applies to subverting your mind, which is exactly what you do when you countenance a breach with reality, a deliberate, willful breach, because then you've overthrown the whole issue of principle and you've pushed yourself, therefore, back into necessarily the life of evil. Now, you should see that this point applies to all human behavior, obviously not simply to the virtue of honesty. And here there is a very good integration we can make that I think will clarify for those of you who know the objectivist epistemology. I did not, in this course, discuss the point that the arbitrary according to objectivism is neither true nor false. I'm assuming that many of you here at least know that point, that if somebody puts forth an arbitrary utterance, just an irrational whim, with no attempt to support it by evidence, it's completely outside the realm of cognition. We don't say that's true. We don't say it's false. We just say nobody said anything because, in fact, cognitively they didn't. Well, in the same way that irrational mental processes detach a conclusion from the realm of cognition, irrational action detaches a goal from the realm of evaluation. That is, I think, a good integration of these two points. I'll repeat that. Just as an irrational mental process detaches a conclusion from the realm of cognition, so irrational action detaches the goal from the realm of evaluation. In other words, whenever an object of any kind, spiritual or material, is sought by a course of behavior in conflict with moral principle, Doesn't make any difference whether the course is fraud or compromise or the initiation of physical force or any evil. Whenever you try to gain an object by violating a moral principle, the means that you employed, by that very fact, clashed with reality and thereby deprived the object of any evaluative status. And this is the deepest reason underlying that statement from Ms. Rand that neither love nor fame nor cash is of value if obtained by fraud. She means that in the literal sense. It literally is outside the realm of evaluation because you are trying it out of context, aside from the only conditions that make evaluation possible. Now you can figure out the objectivist answer to the slogan that the end justifies the means. You know, you're told that, well, some noble ideal can be attained only by evil actions, so in this case, the end justifies the means. Now, this is this statement, which, by the way, to the best of my knowledge, was not invented by a Machiavellian pragmatist, but by the Jesuits, the end being the spread of Catholicism many centuries ago. This statement is nothing more nor less than a license to immorality. The end does not justify the means. In fact, the reverse is true. An immoral means invalidates the end. That is the objectivist view. An immoral means wipes out the end. Now, if you want to take it in the literal sense, there is one end that determines everything, the ultimate end, which is man's life. That, in turn, determines the essential means of human action, which are the principles by which we should live. And they, in turn, delimit concrete objects and tell us which ones we can validly pursue in any given context. So there's a threefold step here. The ultimate value, which determines the virtues, in other words, the principles of proper behavior, which then guide us in the assessment of any concrete object proposed as a goal, such as the $1 million or whatever. And this is the only approach that escapes this impossible dilemma of means versus ends or virtue versus values. Now that you can see why it's preposterous to regard honesty the way conventional moralists do as a form of altruism. They, you see, they think that honesty is a selfless renunciation of all the values you could have obtained by preying on people's gullibility. And you see why objectivism simply sweeps that aside as a pure hash. Honesty, like every other virtue, is a thorough expression of egoism. It's an aspect of one principle on which your selfish survival depends: remaining true to reality. Now, having hammered and stressed to such an extent the issue of principles, I must clarify one brief point. And that is, principles, of course, are absolutes, moral principles we're talking about specifically here, although it would apply to all. But that does not prevent them from being contextual. They are contextual absolutes. Now, if you take the issue of lying, for instance, an intrinsicist who happened to dislike lies, like Kant or the author of the Commandments, simply says flatly, do not lie. Lying is wrong. It's intrinsically wrong. Now, of course, that is not the objectivist view. And the subjectivist says, well, it's just situational. We have to judge each case on its own terms according to our feelings. The objective view of principle is that it is an absolute within the conditions that give rise to and define its applicability. It's an absolute within the appropriate context. So we can make a little more precise the statement that to be good is to be good all the time. That doesn't mean, for instance, to tell the truth all the time. We can now be more precise. To be good is to obey moral principles faithfully without a moment's exception or betrayal within the relevant context, which you must therefore know and keep in mind. So it's perfectly okay, assuming you know this material, to lie to a criminal to lie to a dictator, and even to several other kinds of people. In other words, virtue is not a matter of following concrete-bound rules. Don't lie, don't kill, don't accept financial help from others, which some objectivists have got a hold of as an intrinsicist principle, because Rourke once refused a loan. Always hold a job, honor your parents. That is not virtue. Rules of this sort cannot be defended or consistently practiced. So people just throw up their hands and say there are no applicable rules. We have to recognize the proper approach is that virtues are abstractions, broad abstractions. And then we have to apply all the rules of epistemology to them, including definition by essentials and keeping the context. That's the only way to know what's moral, and it's really the only way to be honest. Now, not to plug my own book, but for a fuller discussion, I refer you to the book in which there is more on the issue of principles. And with that, I'm really brought to the end of the assignment in this little mini course on objectivism. This has been a rapid fire survey, hopefully with some new points to you, of some high points of the objectivist metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. And I want to, in about 2.5 minutes, tie it all together for you by observing in conclusion how right Ayn Rand was to focus on epistemology as the heart and essence of philosophy, and how she carried out this commitment to epistemology, to the primacy of epistemology in her own philosophy. Now, I'm not going to contradict what I said, that existence and so on, all those metaphysical concepts hierarchically precede epistemology. But in terms of formulating an adult philosophic system, obviously, the objectivist metaphysics reflects the objectivist epistemology. In that sense, epistemology is the key governing determiner of all the rest of philosophy. Why did we, in a metaphysics, even think to organize our knowledge of metaphysics into this link leading to this one, existence, identity, causality, the primacy of existence, etc.? What kind of consideration enabled us to know that we need a certain kind of structure going back step by step to primary data? The knowledge that knowledge is hierarchical, that it's structured, that it develops a certain way, that one link is built on the other, and therefore we have to go through an appropriate chain. And that, among many other aspects, was one of the things about knowledge that she had to know, Ayn Rand, before she could even begin to approach what would be a systematic presentation of metaphysics. And of course, that knowledge is hierarchical is a detail of epistemology, a detail in the sense of a derivative, an aspect, a consequence of what? The way we form concepts, the nature of concepts. So metaphysics in that sense is controlled by epistemology. It's even more blatantly obvious as applied to ethics. Why are moral principles necessary? How do you know they're necessary? Why did no one previously grasp their necessity in the way that Ayn Rand did? Principles are merely an expression or a form of conceptual knowledge. And you have to see what concepts are and why they're inescapable before you can see what principles are and why they are inescapable. And the same is true for applying or interpreting principles. For instance, for grasping even that they have a context as opposed to the intrinsicist or subjectivist viewpoint. These are just a few examples, but the whole objectivist ethics, in fact, you should ideally get to the point that you can read it off from the objectivist epistemology. Ethics, the older I get, comes to my, in my mind to stand as really epistemology applied in practice. Even the basic virtue, rationality, its essence, as we saw, if we put it negatively, is don't evade. In other words, Don't disintegrate. In other words, integrate. In other words, practice the right logical objective method of cognition. So the essence of virtue is follow a proper epistemology. You remember Miss Rand defined all the virtues. She always used the expression, virtue such and such is the recognition of the fact that. And that use is deliberate because she wants to say that virtue is the commitment to a process of cognition, to the exercise of your consciousness in a certain way in relation to reality. And that is the subject of epistemology. So you can see, just from this brief touch on it, the tremendous unity, or if we can use the word integrity, of Ayn Rand's philosophy. It is exactly like one of Rorke's buildings. It's all of a piece, objectivism, all interconnected. It all flows from certain revolutionary discoveries in epistemology that redound throughout the system and make it the unprecedented intellectual achievement that it is. In my opinion, the compliment I would give to objectivism is that it's the unity of thought reflecting the unity of reality for the first time. And you know why I think, in my judgment, nothing else and nothing less can save the world if it gets a hearing in the world. And this is why I want to see, or do what I can in my life to see that objectivism does get such a hearing. And I know, of course, that most of you here agree wholeheartedly, and perhaps if we all do what is possible to us, it will at some point receive the justice that it deserves. I hope so, and I thank you. Thank you very much. I certainly appreciate that. And now we still have about 20 minutes left for questions. Yes?
Could you please repeat the statement that the integration you made with the psychology of the natural thing?
I can't hear you.
Could you please repeat the statement of the integration you made with the epistemology with the rational action that is the goal of the realm of evaluation?
Oh, yes. I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but I was very pleased with that connection when I made it. The point was that just as in epistemology, an irrational mental process disqualifies an idea from the realm of cognition, so in ethics or in practice, irrational behavior disqualifies a goal from the realm of evaluation. In other words, in the realm of knowledge, you have to follow certain principles of method to even receive such a compliment as being false. If you simply whistle some idea up and announce it capriciously, it doesn't have any relation to reality. It didn't even reach the stage of contradicting reality. It's outside cognition. And in the realm of behavior, you can make a mistake and commit a wrong action, but if you violate the principles of virtue, then you behave irrationally. That's the counterpart is to the thing you're aiming at no longer qualifies as good. Nor in that fact can you even judge it as bad. All you can say is I've now detached myself from the realm of cognition in ethics. I've thrown out the principles, therefore I have no way to judge now whether this $1 million is good or bad for me, because the only way to judge would be by reference to the principles of morality, which I've now thrown out. So it's exactly a parallel between the two realms. Yes, you have to move. I can't see a stationary hand. Yes, I mean, I could theoretically, but yeah.
When we all live in a culture as opposed to individual actual choices, we all live in cultures which are heavily compromised. And in fact, every culture has been when is it appropriate to support those forces which are at least trying to reduce the amount of compromise, even though there is not a sound epistemological debate?
Are you talking about who to vote for?
Well, it may reduce to that sometimes. But for example, I could see myself voting for Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, I could too, yeah.
Where I couldn't see myself voting
for Ronald. I agree. Well, you're posing a practical question. You're restricting it really to voting, but the principle would apply no matter what the realm was. The question is how to decide to what extent you can support, since all the candidates confronting us are mixed, to what extent are you compromising if you vote for a candidate that you regard as imperfect, who has many evils. For instance, the gentleman says he would vote for Margaret Thatcher, as I would, given what I know about her, and aren't you thereby supporting certain evils in so doing? Compromise morally comes in when you have a choice. If choice is removed from you, you are no longer subject to this principle that's inherent in the context. If one gangster says, I'm going to blow your brains out, and the other one says, I'm going to do it 2 weeks from now, you have every rational grounds, and you are not being immoral or violating principle to say, I'm going with this one, not with this one, because maybe in 2 weeks, who knows? So it simply comes down to, when you're given the lesser of two evils, if it truly is the lesser, you are not compromising. The problem becomes in determining when is it really the lesser. It is not the lesser if the guy purports to accept good ideas and violates them all over the place like Reagan. And that's the worser, not the lesser, because once he gets in, he repudiates them all under cover of giving lip service to them, and the country gets the impression that capitalism and freedom and so on has been tried and failed, and now we need a dose of more statism. So it comes down to this. If you can find between two candidates one who accepts more principled evil than another. It's hard to say more principled good, because there isn't that much principled good, but more principled evil, vote for the other one, if there is a discrepancy of that kind. Like if a guy comes out and says, I am a socialist, and somebody else says, well, there should be some controls, I certainly would vote for the second, you know, who allows some element. But I'm simply saying you have to be able to show in your own mind objectively that there is an actual difference, that one is more committed, heart and soul, to the evil than the other. And that is not by any means obvious. And from this point of view, a person who seems to be indifferent to anything is often a better choice than someone who feels strongly about something in today's world. And that's one reason, and I do not mean to be disrespectful, maybe my wording came out that way, why President Ford was such a good candidate, because he did not have a passionate attachment to some evil principle, as far as you could make out. He seemed to be pretty much, you know, just standard Americanism, and so he was safer. Yes. Thank you.
My question is, the audience that you're targeting for, is it a general audience, the kind of person that's just read Atlas? It sounds sophisticated.
Well, that's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer to that. To what kind of audience is my book targeted? It started as simply, as all my books start, as an edited version of a lecture course that was aimed simply at people who had read Ayn Rand's works, but were not in any way beyond that, not professionals, etc. Only in the course of it, as seems to happen all the time, I got certain ideas for improving it and reorganizing it and expanding it and certain connections, etc. And I'm just now in process of a major reconstruction, which is going to lose me a substantial audience, by means of making it all more hierarchically structured at the price of being less popular. I used to, in an early version, have a chapter on human nature that would get the reader into the book, you know, even though that was way out of order, and I've thrown that out now, and I start at the beginning in a kind of rigorous way. And the way I look at it is that, therefore, it's for a more educated or more philosophically interested audience than I had initially thought. But I think in the long run it'll do more good, because what I think we desperately need is the relatively sophisticated or technical, if you use that word, step-by-step presentation of the entire thing and let the readers fall where they may, rather than the attempt to get quantity at the price of the detailed nonfiction rigor, which I think is crucial. So I've given up any attempt at having a big audience with the idea that the comparatively few that do read it and are interested will do more in the long run. That's the trade-off. Yeah, Phil, you did it again. Yes. Okay.
I was supposed to have the temerity to suggest it would be possible to write two books in parallel.
Would it be possible to write two books in parallel? No. It's hard enough to write one book, let alone two. Somebody else. I take that as self-evident, not requiring explanation. At the back there. Yes.
What children's books will you be reading, or are you reading to your daughter?
Oh, you want to answer that? Yes. What children's books are or will we be reading to our daughter? Wait. She's only two. So at the present, we're using, you know, mostly picture books, and I'm still struggling to get her to sound out the phonetic alphabet, and she still has not really grasped that. So we're telling pretty much the standard. The little golden books are among them, and she likes Curious George and so on, but I don't think you're going to get any philosophic significance out of this yet. We have not really delved into reading on a more advanced or conceptual level. So maybe in several years I can give you what we're doing. Do you have anything you want to suggest here? Okay, we'll take a pass at that one now. Yes?
How are sales of ominous parallels doing?
Poorly. How are sales of the ominous parallels doing? Poorly, by my standards. Now, the publisher is quite pleased, but I still had the delusion that this was my one chance of writing a popular book, you know, on a political rather than an epistemological topic, and by that standard, it's dismal. The last I heard, which was a year or so ago, the publisher had said originally that a book written on this level, with this much philosophy and footnotes, would sell approximately 3,000 copies. And that if it would go to 5, I should be very happy, because basically they're bought by libraries, you know, and an occasional person here and there. And we're something substantial over 30,000. But, you know, that still is not 100,000 nor 14 million either. So, depends what your standard is. Yes?
The lecture description here says
you can
say something about why the concept of certainty.
Oh, you caught me. Okay. Well, the gentleman found that I had put a topic on the brochure that I never commented on. And how could that be? I did this brochure a long time ago, and I just picked a few topics without yet organizing it. And I figured, well, I'll have lots of time to cover my new ideas on the topic of certainty, which was quite a substantial change from the way I covered it in my course. But it turned out I had no time to do it, so I thought I would just ignore it and everybody else would ignore it. So I'll try to indicate to you, but I couldn't give a whole lecture, which I had originally intended, on that. I originally treated certainty as though it was coextensive with knowledge. as though you could say that all knowledge was certain. And there is a sense in which I would still countenance that, but I try to define in my book more exactly why a concept such as certainty is even required once we have the concept of knowledge. And as I thought about it, without taking you through all the steps of the discovery, it occurred to me that there are two essentially different kinds of knowledge. There's certain data that you get that there's no question of accumulating evidence gradually across a span of time and then finally reaching cognition. For instance, take evidence of direct perceptual information, such as that you asked me a question, or that I'm standing here at a lecture, you know, etc. There's millions of facts like that. Or, as another example, there are many different types, not just the example I'm giving, a philosophic axiom, such as the senses are valid, or existence exists independent of consciousness, etc., etc. And there are more also, such as in mathematics, where you get from axioms, just derive the conclusions. In cases like that, are essentially different from cases involving a complex generalization or scientific theory, like the atomic theory, or like all men are mortal, etc., where you acquire evidence step by step, gradually, across an extended period, and where you go typically through first a phase where you have some evidence, and then it's increasingly more probable, and finally you hit the jackpot and say that's cognition. And from that point of view, I think that certainty is applicable only really to this latter. It designates the terminus of a process of accumulating evidence where that process is applicable. If all of our knowledge were, for instance, like the axioms of philosophy, or like direct sensory data, just the conceptual identification of sensory data, it wouldn't serve any use to have certain. There'd be no such thing as possible or probable. There'd just be you know or you're ignorant. You see it or you don't. In which case, knowledge and ignorance would be the total that you need. But it's because on a certain level of complexity, and particularly in regard to inductive conclusions, I think if all of our knowledge were deductive, the same thing would apply. That is, you wouldn't need this concept. But it's in regard really to inductive information, which are essentially generalizations and theory formation, that you go through this process of accumulating evidence, and that's where the concept certainty is essential as the terminus of the process. So I would not now say it is certain that I see a glass. Or rather, you can say it. I mean, I wouldn't prohibit it because, by extension, you can use certain as meaning simply free from all doubt, having no doubt at all. But the issue of doubt wouldn't come up in a rational world if there weren't skeptics who said, how do you know there is a glass? So that's a polemical use. It is very important to keep your concepts, what does reality require apart from polemics? And I do think that apart from polemics, you would simply say, I see the glass, or I don't know that it's there. And the issue of certainty would come up only in regard to certain types of complex inductive information. So from that point of view, I very much restrict the technical use of the term. And that in itself redounds to a much more specific standard of when can you say you are certain. It also answers the question, do you have to say it is certain in a context for every statement? You know, people were bothered, I think, understandably by the statement, this is an eraser in the context, the present context of knowledge. That's ridiculous, because it is an eraser. You can see that it's an eraser, and the issue of context, that kind of stated qualification is just unnecessary. And the reason is precisely because it is reducible to a direct observation, and therefore it's not part of a long, complex continuum of acquiring knowledge. So I would, there are a lot of implications of this new approach. When can you say something is possible, probable, and certain? But that is the that'll give you the, I've said enough to live up to the brochure now. All right, I'll have one last question from somebody. Does somebody have a positive? Yes.
Yes. The French King Louis XV was quoted as saying, in explaining why he didn't support some change in the Austrian regime, it will last as long as I live, and my successors may take care of themselves. We see something wrong with this, but just projecting something from a life range just doesn't make it quite clear on the face of it what that is.
What's wrong with the attitude of a king or a president who would say the system will last as long as I live and let après moi le déluge, after let my successors worry about it? Well, what do you mean what's wrong with it? What is debatable about that? That's like saying I'm going to take drugs and I won't die for a couple of years from them instead of tomorrow. Or I'm 80 years old and I'm going to take a drug that would kill me in 5 years, but I'll be dead at 82 anyway. Well, as far as he personally is concerned, if he wants to do it at 82, then it's not going to do anything. If you know you're going to die tomorrow, I'll give you carte blanche to tell a lie today. It's not going to do anything to your own life. But the fact is, however, that you won't even enjoy the time remaining to you if you act on those principles. To the extent to which the king or the president wants to live a happy, confident life, even if the political results are not going to be total social disaster until the next generation, the evasions and dishonesties and so on that he is going to go through in his own day-by-day life are going to take their toll on him, as they would on any con man, and they're going to wreak all kinds of unearned misery on others. And everyone is going to lose. All your statement means is that the total destruction will not take place for another couple of decades. But that doesn't prove that there isn't gradual and continuous destruction for everybody. Well, it's not exactly a positive note, but that is our time. Thank you.